This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. When climate justice activists demand an immediate transition to renewable energy and a moratorium on fossil fuels, they're often dismissed by political elites as utopian idealists. But the fact is, we have the technology now and the financial capability to do exactly what climate justice demands from us. If we humans are to survive as a species, we've got to stop extracting petroleum created millions of years ago and stored deep within the ground, and we've got to stop burning it to power our industries and lifestyles. We have instead got to power everything we do with electricity that is generated from easily available renewable and low pollution sources of electricity, solar and wind and more. According to my guest and her new book, this transition is imminently doable. Leah Parks is an associate editor of electricitypolicy.com and Electricity Daily. She's the co-author with S. David Freeman of the new book, All Electric America, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future. Welcome to the program, Leah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, how doable is it? You know, we often hear, even how do you explain to the layperson, say, who might agree that we absolutely do have to transition as quickly as possible to all solar, all wind, but, you know, it's a time coming, it's going to take time for us to do that transition, it has to become affordable, et cetera. Are we really that far away from transitioning to renewable energy?
Well, the exciting news is that we are there. Solar and wind technology has now been determined to be actually a mature technology. We're moving out of the earlier phases, and it is being deployed on a very massive scale. We are a very small percentage of our energy comes from solar and wind technology now, but it is ready to go, and the prices have dropped. And have dropped beyond what most experts could imagine.
Okay, so solar and wind, what else is there? I mean, because of course, I think it seems to make sense that any kind of transition to a renewable energy needs to have a menu of options, that there's no one single silver bullet that we need to have a combination of approaches to transitioning, including conservation. But what is there besides solar and wind that we need to rely on?
You're exactly correct. There is a whole menagerie of technologies that will be used for the new 21st century energy infrastructure. So there's solar and wind, there's hydroelectric power. We also have geothermal power, tidal power. The other technology that's very important for this to make this work is the digital technology, because it will help coordinate and balance. So there's something called demand response technology that helps manage all of the electricity. And then of course, storage. I'm mentioning storage late, but storage is very important for this. And storage technology is also now available. And there are many different types of storage technology that will be used actually in this new infrastructure. And Some of the storage technology is following the wind and solar in far as how prices are dropping, and utilities are already implementing cost-effective storage technology. And as we continue, more will come.
So let's talk about what that means. Let's explain it to our audience. So when you say storage technology, I mean, we can certainly create solar power on every sunny day with any solar panel. We put the wind turbines in the right place, we can generate wind energy, but how do we store that? And that has been a challenge for renewable energy advocates for a long time. I mean, do we just build giant batteries that are super efficient? So what are the storage challenges that we have faced and overcome just in the last few years?
Well, battery storage is dropping in price, and it continues to drop. Elon Musk is building a gigafactory right now, and it's predicted that will bring the prices way down.
He's the founder of what is it, Tesla?
Tesla, mm-hmm. Of Elon Musk of Tesla, and they're building a gigafactory in Nevada. And Goldman Sachs, the investment firm, and others are talking about how much batteries will become effective. But batteries are absolutely not the only storage technology. We, of course, have our hydroelectric dams. We store the water and then pump it downstream, or it flows downstream. But there's also hydroelectric technology that's now being used underground, where it's kind of a micro storage or hydroelectric technology. There's compressed air, where they're pushing air into the ground and then it comes out and it generates power. There are flywheels. There's also thermal storage in our concentrated solar plants. There's actually storage built into those where there are molten salts, and the sun will heat that molten salt, which then heats up the water in a steam bin, which will run turbines. And those plants can pretty much run 24 hours a day. I think there is some thermal storage also underground you can use. And, you know, in fact, there are many types of storage that I'm probably not even aware of, because our inventors are constantly working on them, and our universities are working on this technology, and they're used for many different applications.
And so how does this transition happen? I mean, you know, does it come from the top down? Does it come from the bottom up? And that's, of course, the political question. The question of practicality is one, and you're saying that it isn't really a question anymore. But aren't there examples of cities around the world where from the bottom up, people aren't waiting for, you know, a UN treaty? They're simply transitioning. I know particularly in Europe, there's been a very exciting transition in some countries and cities. Give us some examples, some inspiring examples.
Sure. Well, here in I'm in the Northwest. In the Pacific Northwest, Vancouver, British Columbia has voted to become 100% renewable, I believe, by the year 2045. And that came from the city, from movement within the city, but the city decided not to wait for Canada or the world, and they said, we want a completely renewable city. And they have a plan out, and they've done that. Norway is a leader. They've actually set a mandate for their transportation, that all new transportation by the year 2025 will be zero carbon emissions. Denmark, I believe, is wanting to be 100% renewable as the country. But here in the United States, we have some exciting movement as well. San Diego has said that they will be 100% renewable city. They plan to be 100% for their electricity. Hawaii also would like for all of their, has plans now, and the governor, I believe, signed the bill that they'll have all of their electricity run on renewable energy as well. So this is coming from people and grassroots movements as well as the people within our cities and our states that are passing this. And what they're finding, and what the mayor of San Diego, who is a Republican actually, said, that this makes sense. It makes financial sense. It will create jobs. It will bring growth into the city, and Greensburg, I think it's Greensburg, Kansas, also became a completely renewable city. I think they've achieved it, and Aspen, Colorado as well. Well, I could go on,
right?
But there's just a lot of movement. It's very exciting.
So a lot of our political leaders like to propose this idea of transitional energy sources. I know even Democrats and liberal leaders have proposed things like natural gas from fracking as a bridge source of energy towards renewable. And I'm wondering what you make of that. I mean, I can guess, given that you have a section in your book called Natural Gas, The Route to Climate Hell. Nuclear energy is also often suggested as a quote-unquote clean energy. How do you deal with that argument for natural gas and nuclear energy as bridge energies or bridge technologies towards a renewable future?
Well, I'll touch upon natural gas first. Mm-hmm. And natural gas is definitely not clean. It still produces half of the carbon dioxide as coal. And it also leaks methane. So when it leaks enough methane, it's as bad as coal. And we're leaking somewhere between 1.5% to 17%. And around 3%, it's absolutely as bad. But what's interesting with natural gas is we actually use more natural gas than we do coal. We use it for heating as well. So when so we actually are producing about as much greenhouse gases from our natural gas infrastructure as coal. So building any more natural gas at this point will do no good for us at all. In some sense, we are using natural gas now slowly in our transition to get off of fossil fuels. So in that, but to actually build more natural gas infrastructure to bridge us makes absolutely no sense as far as controlling climate change.
So and nuclear energy?
So nuclear energy is also very problematic because it's so dangerous. It is very, very expensive to run and to permit. The insurance is public. We as taxpayers have to pay it because private companies don't want to insure our nuclear plants because, like what happened in Fukushima, we have a terrible waste problem as well. So we don't need nuclear energy to be clean. Our solar and wind energy is mature now, and we can start implementing that right now. The other thing is our nuclear plants are getting old, and there's something called Generation 2 nuclear plants and Generation 3 nuclear plants. The Generation 2 is primarily what we have, and those are the ones that are melting down. And our Generation 3 are basically like our Generation 2, but they have more, they have built them so that there's less of a chance of melting down. But they still have waste problems, and those are terribly expensive. They can't even come close to competing with the inexpensive cost of solar and wind. Mm-hmm. So basically, there's no need to invest in that fuel.
And I'm so glad you put it in those terms. We don't need these dirty energies when we have the clean ones. So how do you envision a future? The cover of your book has this futuristic looking image of, you know, just a dog and a cat driving in an electric car. It looks like a driverless electric car with wind turbines. It looks like a city of Seattle. So how do we get there? And can we get there in our lifetimes? I mean, there's a lot of depressing news out there that suggests that it might be too late. But what's the timeline that you have found that we need to get to this future by immediately?
Well, first of all, the timeline does seem to change as our climatologists tell us more and more dire news. The Paris Treaty has basically decided, which we agree with in our book, that a 2 degrees Celsius limit is the temperature rise we should stay under.
Although many say 1.5 degrees is really where we need
right.
to be.
Yes, so 1.5 is where we need to be, and we should get no higher than 2 degrees Celsius is kind of, they've set this ceiling of we better not go above that, you know, and let's try to be at 1.5 really hard. And if we can get to 1.5, that's ideal. In order to stay below 2 degrees Celsius, we have to reach zero emissions by the year 2050. So we have about 35 years, which means on average, the world needs to start reducing its fossil fuel infrastructure by about, and the carbon emissions by about 3% per year is what we found. We need to do more if we want to hit 1.5 degrees Celsius. We'll need to do it faster than that, kind of probably by the year 2030.
What is standing in our way? What is the biggest thing standing in our way if we have the technology now, if we have the capability now, if we have the money now? We do have the money now. I mean, some of it is stored in the trillions that billionaires stash offshore. And so we certainly shouldn't believe this idea that there isn't enough money. What is really standing in our way of doing this immediately for, you know, cities across the country and or the world to say, we're just going to outfit every new house with solar panels that we're going to pay for. We're going to start building wind turbines immediately. We're going to, you know, force car manufacturers to up the production of electric vehicles and subsidize it and phase out gas-driven cars. There should be nothing standing in our way. What is?
Right. There really shouldn't be anything standing in our way. This is absolutely doable and financially doable. It would really take about 2% of our gross domestic product, which is just a tiny amount.
Wow.
But what's standing in our way is inertia. and the fossil fuel interests. Right now, our fossil fuels are what I like to call the buggy whip on steroids, because it is our buggy whip energy technology. That is 20th and 19th century technology we're using. And just like we stopped using oil from whale blubber to light our homes, we will stop using fossil fuels as well. But our fossil fuel industry is very wealthy and has a lot of power. And there's also inertia. And there is the can't-do attitude that many people have. And I think it's natural human nature. And one example of that inertia is that we don't fully... It's hard for us, I think, as we get older, and many of the people who are running our electricity infrastructure, who are just running the infrastructure of our society, our political infrastructure, we're all older. And I think it's hard for us to envision this change. We are so used to it. We grew up on gas-guzzling cars. We remember the sound of them and driving them in our motorcycles. But this, I think it's much easier for young people to do this. And an example I give is I went to a conference hosted by the Department of Energy, and there were a bunch of folks from the electricity industry. The head of Portland General Electric was there. And everybody was saying, we want to move to a carbon-free, greenhouse gas-free future. Many people were excited about it. They had electric cars. But the average age was maybe 40 or maybe 50. And everybody was saying, oh, our hands are tied because of this, and we're not sure, and I don't fully believe, and I'm skeptical. And I came home, and within a day, a friend of ours showed up at our house with a leaf, his leaf. And my children came out and looked at his leaf, and his children were there. The electric car, his leaf. And they looked under the hood and saw no motor and saw that we could plug it in. And my daughter said, who was 6 at the time, said, why aren't we doing this? This is ridiculous. Why would we want stinky gas? Why would we want, you know, this dirty stuff that pollutes the air? This is simple. This is obvious. And then you take a ride in one of these amazing cars and you realize, wow, this is fun. This is convenient. Why aren't we doing it? So I believe, honestly, I do believe the fossil fuel industry is obviously they're trying to fund misinformation. They have been funding misinformation. They're trying to slow down the inevitable transformation we're having. But a lot of really good people out there who want it, I think it's our own inertia as well.
Well, Leah, give out a website where people can find out more about the book that you've co-written.
Oh, yes, I do. It's allelectricamerica.com.
And we'll post a link there from our website later today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was very fun.
Leah Parks is an associate editor of electricitypolicy.com and Electricity Daily. She's the co-author with S. David Freeman of the book we've just been discussing, All Electric America, Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.